Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents And Put Away Childish Things by Adrian Tchaikovsky. Narrated by Adrian Tchaikovsky. Acknowledgements. Thank you to my beta readers and fact-checkers, Liz Miles, Emma Reeves and Chantal Delaney, for keeping me on the straight and narrow with various parts of this narrative. Chapter 1. It is said that long ago there were many ways into the land of Underhill, but one by one they fell away. Until, search as you would, you might never find your way from the comforting world we all know into that place of magic and adventure. But for James and Jemima, fleeing from the cruel Mr. Ragstaff, the entrance was just a path into the woods they had never noticed before, twisting between the gnarled old trees. The Road to Underhill, 1947. Mary Bodie, Golden Century Press. Breaking into television was proving unexpectedly stressful for Harry, which seemed particularly unfair given that he was on the cusp of 40 and had been working in TV for 2.5 decades. He'd assumed he'd be in his stride by now, but then he'd made the mistake of swerving out of his lane, and suddenly it was this invisible maze of attitudes and prejudices, all of which seemed to be personified in Margot Lorne, the semi-beloved presenter of How Even Me. Margot Lorne was not even slightly beloved of or by Harry. Their few days of association had kindled an intense, unspoken dislike between the two of them. By mutual and instant agreement, they expressed this by being overjolly and backslappish, all not-quite-touching hugs and kissing the air past their cheeks, each ringing with distaste for their opposite number. Margot Lorne had gone to a mid-ranking drama school and landed some roles in The Bill and Casualty. She now found her comfortable rut being the pleasant, chatty face of programmes where celebrities got to bare their hearts, usually when they had a book out, or a new show on, or some other reason to remind the general public of their existence. Felix Harry Bodie, on the other hand, had gone to a different mid-ranking drama school and scored a couple of roles on EastEnders and the early run of Doctors. He'd found his feet presenting children's programming as one of the revolving cast of hosts on the CBeebies circuit, providing filler segments between the gaily coloured puppets and cartoon characters. They had never even met before Harry's stint on Margot's programme. Possibly the problem was that, right then, Harry had a huge chip on his shoulder about anyone whose broadcasting career didn't involve having to work with bloody kids. He had already alienated a fair number of his regular co-hosts for exactly the same reason, because they all seemed to be able to caper and gurn and get through the interminable clapping songs without wanting to drop an F-bomb in front of 500,000 4-to-7-year-olds. Not so he. And there was the elephant in the room, of course. His other ersatz claim to fame that he simultaneously insisted wasn't important, while being secretly resentful that it hadn't somehow propelled him, magically, to greater heights of success. The books. Bloody Underhill. And so, because he was in the midst of one of his sporadic attempts to break into serious drama, he'd agreed to go on How Even Me, and expose his genealogy to the glaring public spotlight that was Margot Lorne's warm smile and gentle Scots accent. His agent reckoned it would be good PR at just the time when Harry's resume turned up on people's desks. And Margot's production company had taken him on because his genealogy included one children's author who was at least vaguely remembered 70 years after her works first came out. From Margot's perspective, they were doing Harry a solid. From Harry's perspective, he was slumming it for the sake of a future career where he didn't have to gurn or caper even a little, save in service of the serious actor's art. By halfway through the first day of filming, taking a chainsaw to the lesser branches of Harry's family tree, they loathed each other with a polite and icy passion. It turned out that Harry's maternal great-grandfather, hitherto known to the family as a respected captain of industry and conservative MP hopeful, had been neck-deep in a stock market scandal, and had actually done time at Her Majesty's pleasure. This was unaccountably something that had never come up at the family dinner table, and Margot's expression of woeful sympathy had glimmered with gloating triumph. Harry spent that evening on the phone to the production company insisting that they cut or downplay it, hide it amongst the except they had turned up very little else of interest in that part of the family, so the whole white-collar crime angle was looking mighty attractive as a crowd-pleaser. "It'll be fine," he told a succession of executives in tones between a grovel and a growl. "We're doing the book stuff tomorrow. Magda, Mary, Bodie, my sainted gran. Bury it behind that, and maybe, just maybe, it'll be better than you imagine. You just wait." Because Gran had had a secret. All right, not a secret, because she'd told it to her sole daughter, Harry's mum. She told it to Harry, she told it to quite a lot of people at the care home, and a number of medical professionals, too. But that last drawn-out part of her life wasn't the way Harry wanted to remember her. A non-secret, then. A non-secret about her own mother, the great-grandmother neither Harry nor anyone else in the family had ever met. The mysterious woman whose stories, back in Magda's own childhood, had been the inspiration for the Underhill books in the first place. "Your great-grandma," she used to say, "was someone very special. She came to this country from somewhere where she was very important." And she'd touch her brow in a special way, and child Harry could almost see the glint of gold and gems there. And Magda had something of a Slavic feel to it, obviously, and Bodie wasn't necessarily their original surname. And, well, Harry wasn't actually saying that he was the rightful Tsar of all the Russias, but he had wondered. Not enough to actually put the legwork into investigating, admittedly, but why would he need to when he had the whole research team of how even me to do it for him? Even if that team was mostly a harassed-looking office junior called Mai. Which unfortunate piece of nomenclature led to endless how-even-my jokes from the rest of the crew. Mai was the only person on set who disliked every other human being involved even more than Harry. Ever the consummate professional, Margot's greeting on the second day was an actor's masterclass in how to sparkle for the camera while showing your colleague just how much you dislike him. At least today they were dealing with the good stuff. In their hearty air-kissing was the understanding that they would both mind today for whatever they could get out of it and then never have to see one another again. They were in the Oxford Story Museum for the shooting. How even me preferred to film in the attics of their guests' grand houses where they could pretend to unearth dusty old photographs of sainted ancestors undergoing privation or doing praiseworthy things. Harry's two-room flat was unaccountably missing an attic because the house had gone with Lisa along with most of the money during the divorce. However, the museum still had a wall panel about the Underhill books as one of its permanent exhibits. And probably the whole thing got waved through as mutual good PR that didn't have to impact on anyone's balance sheet too much. They positioned him in front of the display. There were a couple of first editions, the once bright covers faded, plus some stills from that 1973 animation, and a creepy little puppet from the Polish stop motion of 87, which still featured in Harry's nightmares. With that as a backdrop, they did the preliminaries, the little interview sections where he reminisced fondly about Granny Magda, or Mary as her pen name had been. He even went so far as to mention the secret, those little hints she dropped about the provenance of her own mother. And he wasn't really expecting Margot to play God Save the Tsar and then crown him, but it was nice to have the whiff of it hanging in the air. And he relaxed and let his guard down, and then they brought out the box. "Harry," Margot said. And he'd wanted them to call him Felix. He wanted to start calling himself Felix instead of the god-awful clownish Harry, that non-name he'd taken on and which he was thoroughly sick of. But he was Harry Bodie to the world, and to equity, and his agent reckoned it was still more help than harm when it came to names to conjure with. "Harry," Margot said. "What would you say if I told you that we'd been able to track down some real information about your great-grandmother? Far more than Mary ever told you." And, the bitch, she was doing her excited voice, as she did in every show where the guest's past held a cornucopia of riches rather than hardship and grief. And he should have thought that they could easily reshoot her part later if she wanted to give it the opposite spin. That the Margot Lawn speaking to him then and there needn't be the one who made it to screen. He fell for it, hook, line and sinker. And they had a box there. An old metal chest that eagle-eyed aficionados of how even me might have recognised as turning up in a number of mid-list celebrity attics, because the show got sloppy with reusing its props. Because they wanted the true and honest reaction, they passed it into his hungry hands for him to open. They'd arranged the papers inside quite carefully, so that their narrative was laid out step by step. The admission notice, the treatment reports, the doctor's notes, the birth certificate. Filming as Harry's excited sounds of discovery ground down to something bleak and sad. The London County Asylum was stamped on half the pages. That was where his great-grandmother had turned up, apparently. January the 8th, 1916, which he reckoned were the time when the asylums were doing a booming trade, so small wonder the paperwork looked rushed. Admission of a pregnant woman, answering to the name of Devati Svoboda, initially speaking no English, though she appeared to have picked it up pretty quickly. No clue as to where she'd come from, but the country had a lot on its mind right then, and incurably deranged, as the spiky handwriting of one professional had it. Possessed of such detailed and elaborate delusions that the specialist had insisted she be kept in residence for study. She claimed to be the Queen of Fairyland, said the notes. Her daughter had been taken from her, obviously. Named Magda at her insistence, permitted to visit by the unusually lenient foster family and the indulgent alienist who'd sat in on their encounters. Listened to the increasingly lurid fantasies she'd spun for the kid. Honestly, for a destitute pregnant woman beset by incurable delusions, great-grandma had fallen on her feet. She'd died in the institution in 1930, the record said, of pneumonia. And Harry did his best. And probably he could have turned the whole thing into a career exercise whereby he used the heartstrings of the audience as bootstraps for his upcoming career. But in that instant, wrong-footed as he was just so painfully aware that Margot Lorne and her entire crew were laughing at him. That they'd all taken a profound dislike to him from the first moment he turned up, on the not unreasonable basis that he'd made himself profoundly dislikable. And so his reaction was less noble sorrow and more peevish anger that his goddamn great-grandmother hadn't been anything more useful to him. And the cameras were rolling all the time. Worse than that, if even possible, was the next 2 months of him calling the production company with threats, and then having his agent call them with the same threats phrased in more professionally appropriate language, and then having some lawyers call them with different threats that cost Harry rather more money than he'd have preferred to spend and got him precisely nowhere. He'd signed a contract before going on the show, and nowhere in that contract did the words power of veto appear. And so they were damn well going to use what they'd got. And at last, just as he was doing his bit in the CBeebies 2019 Christmas panto, the show was broadcast and it all became public knowledge. Enough interest was generated by the clashing wheels of children's TV presenter and Madness in the Family for him to become a cause célèbre in the worst way. A little digging by responsible journalists turned up his own string of therapists, and the failed marriage, and the couple of years when his drinking had got seriously out of hand. It hadn't taken a great deal of glue to stick these together into the picture of a man with his own issues, inherited or otherwise. And then, given that it was the start of 2020 and people were beginning to get twitchy about this new virus, the news cycle moved on. His agent, Steve, was pessimistic over the phone. I hate to say it, but it's the Queen of Fairyland bit. People are funny about mental health, aren't they? Doesn't exactly jibe with serious, proper actor. Unless you fancy milking it. Play up the sorrow and the woe about poor great-grandma. Ostentatiously do a charity gig for an appropriately themed good cause, the sort of thing that Felix Harry Bodie, hungry would-be grown-up actor, would do. Except Harry had by then watched his own lamentable performance on How Even Me approximately 9,000 times, and had come to the conclusion that Felix Harry Bodie was a bit of a shit, and that his great-grandmother had genuinely been hard done by. He discovered, to his surprise, that he didn't have the heart to turn his family sorrows into a career mill after all. The thought of the bedridden old woman insisting she was queen of nowhere to the daughter she hadn't been able to keep. It turned out there were actually depths he wasn't willing to plumb. "Felix, mate, you're not exactly helping me here," said Steve. And Felix said rather sharply that he'd thought it was the agent's job to help him, and that was another bridge half burned. And there were looks from his colleagues at the BBC, and on the street as well, When the occasional kid wanted a photo, he could read any kind of pity or lip-curling disdain he wanted into the expressions of the adults. It was as though a brush had reached out a century through time and tarred him with mental instability. "He's the one with the madwoman in his family. Is he dangerous, do you think? Should he even be as close to our children as on the other side of the TV screen?" He started drinking again. Or drinking more, because despite all the professional advice, he'd never been able to go dry. Not in entertainment, where everyone was positively pickling themselves the moment they turned the cameras off. He was definitely drunk when he came back to his flat in the small hours one night in February, after the world had mostly forgotten about him again. He was drunk when he dropped his keys in the rosebush-snarled patch of garden out front, and ended up on his hands and knees muttering to himself as he tried to find them. It hadn't been a good night. The pub had been mostly empty, his fellow TV types crying off because of the growing aversion to crowds and public spaces. He'd downed 4 solitary pints and then swung by the off-license so he could take the festivities home with him. He felt he was watching his career and life fall apart in slow motion, and every time he had a chance to reverse the course, somehow he did exactly the opposite, which left him cursing God, the devil, and several named production executives as he fumbled for his lost keys in the near pitch dark and skewered himself on rose thorns. "Here," said someone, and abruptly the missing items were dangling before his face. He staggered upright, snatching them from the air on the second try, feeling their inarguable cold metal edges pressing into his palm, crusted with soil from the garden as though they'd been unearthed from a grave. "What? Right. Thanks," he blurted out, and then looked at the someone and sobered up pretty much immediately. Not literally, of course, biochemistry working as it does, but a savage cocktail of other hormones overrode the worst of the drink, because something in him was screaming, "Fight or flight!" And being a sedentary middle-aged TV presenter, he just froze up and did neither. Tall, freakishly tall, although as Harry was only 5'8", maybe just very tall, wearing a long coat like a flasher, standing weirdly, every part of him held wrong, the legs as though the man was right on the balls of his feet, and then those feet were stretched too long, sour reek of spoilt milk, aquiline face with a briar patch beard and sunken eyes, filthy, ancient, like a vagrant, like an icon of a saint unearthed from a dig site. Looked at one way, exactly the sort of disturbed homeless man Harry would cross the street to avoid. Looked at another, an ancient king. The horns. They were ridged like a ram's, curving back into rook's nest hair. The roots of them, growing from his temples, were unmissable. "Harry Bodie," said the thing, said the delusion, incipient madness, drink-born hallucination, and, "No!" shrieked Harry Bodie, dashing for the door, fumbling the newly reclaimed keys into the lock, waiting for the long, bony hand on his shoulder, slamming the door behind him loud enough to wake everyone in the building, trying the door 3 times to reassure himself it had locked, not looking out there, not glancing back as he thundered up the stairs, not giving himself a moment's thought. And the window of his flat only faced an alley, and he didn't look out of it anyway. And when he awoke the next morning, hungover and still dressed, none of it had gone away. None of it had proved soluble in the alcohol he'd imbibed that night. There had been a man with horns and goat legs in the garden. And because there patently couldn't have been a man with horns and goat legs in the garden, that meant he must be going mad. Chapter 2. "But where is my medal?" Wishdog howled. "Without it, I cannot call my friends, and without them, the ogre will run all the way to the castle gates." "It is that rascal Timon," Jemima called out. "He has taken it for his coat." James nodded. "Then you must find where he is hiding and claim it back, and Wishdog and I will slow the ogre as best we can while you do." Now, while the children were saying this, Timon the fawn was running helter-skelter through the mouldy woods. At first he had been running because he wanted to bring the medal home as swiftly as possible. Then he had been running because he had thought how angry Wishdog might be. At last he was running even faster because the mouldy woods were not a friendly place, and he was being chased. Following his hoofprints, patient and dreadful, came the long-legged stride of the Giants of Underhill, 1949, Mary Bodie. Golden Century Press. The Underhill books were still in print, and indeed a slow trickle of royalties made a sporadic contribution to Harry's rent via the fund that oversaw the estate. They were the usual sort of post-war kids' stuff born out of a world of rationing, so that the young protagonist's rewards for fighting giants or recovering stolen jewellery was often no more than a decent meal, which they were glad to get. They were 50s nostalgia that the baby boom generation had grown up on, about another world that was green and magical and nice, and constantly under threat by monsters both buffoonish and genuinely monstrous. And there had been a magic dog and a tree spirit woman and an hilarious clown, which, even just in print on the page, had creeped young Felix the fuck out, frankly. And a fawn. And the fawn, in the books, about whom the adjective rascally was used rather more often than necessary, had not much resembled the figure he had seen in the garden. There had been no rascalhood about that ancient mariner apparition. 2 days after the event, the sight was still knife-edge sharp in his mind. He kept waiting for time to blur it to a point where he could discount the whole business and move on. It didn't happen. The sight of the horned destitute was imprinted on his mind as hard as if the man had headbutted him. It wasn't as though the old demons of anxiety and depression were being kept far from the door, what with the how even me fallout. And he'd had the odd hallucination before, real enough in the moment, far more easily dismissed in retrospect. And therapists had put them down to stress, or, in one case, some spectacular side effects of misprescribed medication. It wouldn't even be the first time he'd hallucinated something that might plausibly be connected with the whole Underhill nonsense, which had been on his mind recently for obvious reasons. Another thing he did, as well as get anxious and depressed and see things, was what one specialist had called unhealthy ideation. Not even about himself per se, but taking ideas into grotesque places that he couldn't then unthink. He'd made the mistake of telling his agent about it once, and Steve had said, "Harry, mate, write it down. Do me a script. This stuff's gold dust right now." And hadn't understood why Harry would rather have pulled his own fingernails out than make it any more real. "It'll be, what's the word, an exorcism, mate. Catharsis, isn't it?" Harry was very worried that it wouldn't be at all cathartic. Less an exorcism than a conjuration. And again, that had been him not being helpful. When he had been very young, and an avid reader of his own grand's books, he had wished that the various colourful characters would actually turn up in his life. That he could play games with the dog and the fawn, although not with Gombles the clown, that god-awful nightmare who Gran obviously felt was such a fucking riot. And now, 40 years old, his unhealthy ideation presented him with a gleefully detailed scenario to add to the list of things he couldn't unsee. "What if you got your wish back then?" his mind whispered to him in the small hours, impervious to the scotch he'd knocked back. "Except, what if they just couldn't find you? What if they'd been searching all these years, getting old, getting angry, and now they finally turned up to play?" "Fuck off!" he shouted at the top of his voice at 3 in the morning, because insomnia was in the mix as well. The residents in the neighbouring flats likely didn't appreciate that he meant his inner demons and not them. Work was problematic, what with the new precautions and restrictions they were bringing in, and which Harry was too tired and sometimes hungover to get his head round. And he couldn't exactly say, "Well, yes, but I saw an impossible monster man in the garden last week, so I'm still a bit fragile," because that would only make things worse. Mid-February brought a suspicious absence from someone on the crew, rumours of serious illness, and then Harry ended up pre-recording a great undigested wadge of links and getting sent home along with most of his little clique of presenters. "Await further instructions," went the instructions, which were not then followed by any further instructions. Too much time on Harry's hands brought fragmentary nights broken up by a shotgun pattern of waking out of bad dreams. In those dreams, his unhealthy ideation was having a field day. And it wasn't just the Underhill characters who'd been making their way for decades in an unfriendly human world, it was all the comic cartoon creations from the kids' shows he'd done linking segments for. The claymation penguins and anthropomorphic vegetables and glove puppet caterpillars, all of them grown up, and eking out a living as supermarket checkout clerks and office cleaners, as accountants and secretaries and technical helpline call centre telephonists, trying to work out how to pay their taxes when their arms were moved by rods and they had no opposable digits, explaining to the police how they'd swerved and knocked out the driver's side headlamp of a bus when they were a 2D scribble of a freckled girl with unfeasibly long pigtails, or a Picassoan cartoon pig with both eyes on the same side of its face. And the real-world human policeman would nod and frown and make notes, and the cartoon pig or duck or flower would be getting more and more anxious as they tried to explain that they were late for work now and there were bills to pay, and it was a long time since they'd been on that programme or in that happy little book about friendship. And couldn't the policeman just cut them some slack, because their cartoon moose spouse was already talking about going to their cartoon moose parents to get some space to think about the marriage, and little Timmy the moose, duck, flower, pig, whatever, was getting teased at school, probably for being some sort of cartoon hideous monster animal plant hybrid as far as Harry was concerned, and he woke up in tears at the desperate, doomed attempts of all the kids' TV characters to navigate the banal complexities of the world, as they lost their credit cards and got the wrong times for meetings and were hopelessly baffled by Microsoft PowerPoint, so that the big presentation for work on Monday was an unmitigated disaster. And the dreams weren't even about him. He was just a powerless observer watching these stupid cartoon animals ruin their lives. As though all of this really had been some kind of exorcism, his agent got on the phone the next day to say that Birmingham Rep had made some inquiries about whether he might be Edgar in a production of Lear they were looking at. And he bit back a lot of bile about this just being because they wanted to capitalise on his family history of lunacy, and said yes, that would be lovely, serious acting role, just the thing. Because it was a good part, and it was a good company, and who really cared what ulterior motives there might be behind the casting? When a call came through soon after, he thought it was probably someone from the Rep and answered it immediately. And then there was a bit of a pause on the other end, and he went very cold and scared, and somehow unable to kill the call, in case the voice that eventually came to him should be that of an ancient destitute faun. He couldn't even have said what that would sound like. He just knew he'd recognise it. The voice that finally spoke was a woman's, though, and there was nothing particularly decaying or faun-like about it. Dry, a smoker's roughness overlaying faded posh. The sort of voice he knew from actors who'd had some family cash backing them a while back but had been making their own way since. Not unlike his own, he supposed. "Is that Mr. Bodie?" she asked. And he realised the long pause preceding that might have been because he hadn't said anything when he answered the call. And then, "Mr. Felix Bodie?" And of course he was Harry, to just about anyone in the business, and Harold to spam callers because of the way he filled in internet forms. Being addressed by his actual name was the one thing that stopped him putting the phone down. "Who is this?" he asked. "I mean, yes, it is. Are you the press?" Simultaneously feeling the plunge of, "Are they not done with me?" and the swoop of, "Perhaps they're not done with me." "My name's Rebecca Seichman, Mr. Bodie. I'm calling from Seichman and Sachs, solicitors." Jesus, what now? What had he done to have the relentless hounds of litigation set on him? "Mr. Bodie? What's it about?" Hearing his voice shake. "Look, aren't you supposed to send me a letter? My agent usually fields them, or can I give you my lawyer's details?" Although that would involve him having to pay his lawyers. "Ah, no," Seichman said after a moment. "This isn't one of those calls." She sounded as though she was enjoying herself, which he felt was a terrifying trait in a solicitor. "Actually, I wanted to talk to you about a potential claim you might be in a position to bring." "Oh, Jesus, no, you are not going to start talking about... Look, I never took out any PPP. I don't even know what it stands for. I wasn't in a car accident. I don't own a car. I haven't..." "Mr. Bodie, it's about the Underhill IP." For a moment he heard Underhill IPA, and wondered if the trust had licensed a children's book series to a brewery. While it didn't seem likely, he'd seen a fawn in the garden and so wasn't the best arbiter of plausibility. Then his brain caught up. Intellectual property. Lawyer stuff. "The trust handled..." he said weakly, but she cut him off. "Mr. Bodie, I just happened to be researching one of my regular cases when I came across some information relating to the Underhill books and your family." "And you'd been on, you know, That.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?